Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Today on the show is a lawyer from the European Space Agency, ESA, and we are super happy about that. Now, you might ask what lawyers do in space, and the answer is more and more. Space is filling up with more and more activity. We humans seem to be getting restless on the chunk of rock we inhabit. The third space age has long begun. Space shuttle astronaut Nicole Stott has referred to the Apollo years on our show as the years of the pioneers. And now it's the turn of a new generation, the settlers, perhaps. But as it is with us humans, we need rules or we won't function as social beings. The English philosopher Thomas Hobbes already described it in detail in the 17th century that we humans have to give up our naturally given freedoms if we want to live together in communities, because otherwise we are wolves to one another. Homo homini lupus. Man is a wolf to man. And this is precisely why democratic models of society are based on contracts, here on Earth and in space. Welcome, space lawyer Alexander Suchek from ESA.
Sorry, thank you for having me.
Alex, some say that if you want to get a project done in time, you shouldn't engage lawyers too much. The space industry undergoes a rapid evolution these days. So can jurisdiction keep up with the pace of technological progress?
You know, I have heard this sentence very often. It actually takes me back to the times when I've done an internship at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, NASA headquarters, back in 2003. And I remember walking in a room at Goddard filled with scientists and engineers, and welcoming as many friends in the US are. They said, oh, hi, Alex, oh, from Europe, wonderful. So what's your background? And I said, I'm a lawyer. And you could feel the temperature change in the room and say, oh, well, nevertheless, come here, sit down. You know, so I'm used to this, and I might have seen it as an offense years ago, but actually I don't, because I do understand that for someone who has nothing to do with the mysteries of law, the way a lawyer thinks and what a lawyer considers important to do might be difficult to understand, simply because the world an engineer lives in or a scientist lives in and a lawyer lives in are different worlds. They are worlds apart, literally.
Is the pace of technological evolution as it is happening right now a hindrance to your work? Because I could imagine that trying to get all those contracts in place and do all the negotiations necessary to build a legal framework for a new kind of space-related endeavor, is it possible to keep up with the pace of the actual endeavor?
It's a challenge. So just to give you two examples, if you speak about negotiating a contract between a company and a subcontractor, so you need some parts in order to build the instrument or the payload on board of your future satellite, that's something that is fairly easy to do in terms of timing, because you speak the same language. You are two private companies wanting to make business. Ultimately, there are standard ways how you approach each other. So writing a private law contract between two companies or between a subcon and a prime is, I'm not saying it's trivial, it's very complicated negotiations, but it's doable in a comparatively short time frame. Whereas if you sit at the United Nations and you have to agree on, say, a new treaty on principles pertaining to the exploration and use of outer space with 100 governments all around the world, then this is by its nature already much more complex. And that's, and you're absolutely right, a challenge when you have to react or accompany a field like modern space where developments go so fast, which is absolutely exciting. But yes, keeping up is not always easy.
Wow. So tell me, what's your personal favorite space project currently?
Oh,
of course, you're with ESA, so you're a little biased here, but what fascinates you most at the moment?
Look, see, this is the diplomat in me and the lawyer. So the first answer is it depends, of course. So this off the top of your head is always a tricky question with a lawyer. No, but seriously speaking, I since early childhood days was and still am a passionate astronomer. I love planetary exploration and human spaceflight, of course. Though the first 10 years of my professional life in ESA, I've worked in Earth observation. And I learned to know and to appreciate this fascinating world of looking back to our own planet, studying climate change, the weather, meteorology, and all kinds of things. So these application programs are tremendously useful and exciting. But if you really ask what's deep down in my heart, you know, driving my fascination, why I'm in the space world, then it's exploration to go out, you know, as some TV series say, to boldly go where no one has gone before. It doesn't have to be so far. It's already exciting enough just to go a little bit up in low Earth orbit and look outward into the universe.
Would you want to be on board such a mission as a spaceship lawyer?
I got this question often. Would you like to be on board of a spaceship? And the first impulse, the first reaction probably almost anyone would have is to say, yeah, of course.
Sure.
But then, to be very honest, I don't know. Because I don't know if I had the guts, if I had the courage to sit on top of a cylinder filled with, I don't know how much highly explosive fuel and go up to reach a velocity of 28,000 and something kilometers per hour, be in 400 or 500 kilometers altitude and not being totally sure that the return ticket actually lives up to, you know, what is written right on paper.
It's promise.
Yeah, the promise. I'm not sure if I would love to ride the rocket, but I would like to beam aboard the International Space Station, spend a day there, and then safely beam back into the backyard of my house and open a good glass of wine and dream of what I've just lived.
That's a very good segue into my next question, because beaming is a huge reference into the future. Who wouldn't want to be able to beam wherever they might want to go? So as a space lawyer, in how far do you have to incorporate future technologies?
Of course, law at the end of the day has always a very pragmatic side to it, because you do need to solve questions that are asked today. That doesn't mean you don't have to prepare the future. On the opposite, if you think the first space lawyers writing about the problems brought by space flight, they did their works in the 1920s and the 1930s, where no rocket ever had left into Earth orbit or above a certain altitude. And yet it was clear that one day that would come around the corner. And so you have these people who back almost 100 years ago thought of what would be the legal problems of space flight once it was possible. And in fact, only 20 years later, October 57, the first Soviet rocket launched into outer space. So in a way, what we think today as of science fiction or technologies of tomorrow can become reality sooner than we think.
Sure.
And therefore, law always has to look also ahead. At the same time, it's not about dreaming how future colonies on Mars might be best regulated. That will also come one day, maybe not in 2021, but it doesn't have to be the colony on Mars or crossing the outer borders of the solar system. There are a lot of ideas how to explore outer space that will be reality in a few years, and where we have today already to look into legal problems that we might face in a few years.
I'm taking total advantage now of you being on the show as an expert for space law. And please excuse if this is a rather stupid question, but is there a legal framework for an alien encounter? So what if an alien spaceship turn up at some point? Do we have a legal framework for such an encounter? What to do?
No, there is no legal framework in the sense of, say, an agreement among governments who would take the first step and ask the first question and hand over a flag and which flag that would be. There are considerations and there are texts actually about that. And it's a fascinating idea to think, how would we react? But I like pragmatic solutions. And what I answer to my students when they ask this question, precisely this question, I say, that moment that we stand in front of an alien, I think a legal protocol will be the last thing we worry about, the good or in the bad.
Wonderful. Alex, what's your take on the current evolution within the space industry?
I think we see and witness and live incredibly dynamic times. Dynamic times are always exciting times because things change, new things come up. And with things, in this case, new space actors, new types of space ventures, new types of using outer space, new ideas to explore outer space. Someone recently has written it's the second space age in a way. We've seen this excitement and all these promises back in the 1950s, but mostly in the 1960s. Then the 70s, 80s, it died a bit away. Of course, there were exciting programs at those times as well. But you have the feeling that these days, you live again in a world where so many people are excited about going into space and doing things there. You see, space is relevant again. It always has been relevant, but it's perceived as being relevant. And that's good because this is the environment where new things grow and the new adventures happen.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point you're making, because I believe that we are just experiencing a very natural evolution when it comes to venturing into new territory as human beings. So if you take, for example, the pre-aeroplane time, we had no legal framework as to what to do with the air above. And as soon as we developed aeroplanes, we had to make up our minds as to what to do with the above, so to say. Then we dealt with that. And now the next step is, what do we do with the above above?
Yes, you have, of course, to distinguish two things. One is what is actually practically happening in the space world, what companies are being formed, what missions are being undertaken, what investments are being made. That's one thing. The legal world is worth a separate look. How does law, as you also asked before, react to those developments and anticipates new developments? But one thing is very clear. Law always has accompanied humans, the development of humankind, because this is a fascinating thing. Law is about people and about how people can act with one another, live with one another. It's ultimately expectation management. What lawyers do in the best sense of law is to manage expectations, current ones or future ones. And so the more expectations change and grow, the more law has also to be developed or adapted or interpreted in different ways than it had been before. And this makes it so fascinating because it's a quest that will never stop, that will never end. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a nice image of the past. When you think how the law of the sea developed, ultimately, looking back, you know, not only centuries, but even millennia, at the very beginning when humans only ventured a few hundred meters or kilometers off the shore, you know, they didn't think of the high seas as a legal problem. They didn't maybe even know what the high seas actually were. So in the middle of the ocean somewhere, it was not a problem because it didn't exist in the daily life of people. Once ships could venture further out, then other legal problems came along. And it's a little bit the same when you think about air law didn't exist in the 15th century, because except some hot air balloons, maybe, even those came later, there was no use case. It was maybe an imagination, but nothing more than that. And so air law was born when the first plane came. And space law was born when the first rockets stood on the launch pad. And that means their internet, cyber law, didn't exist 50 years ago, 60 years ago, because there was no cyberspace. And I'm sure if we have another interview in about 50 to 100 years, the two of us will speak about different legal problems, different than we could imagine.
Interplanetary law, interstellar law, for example.
Whatever you want.
Okay, cool. One of the most dynamic players these days is, of course, SpaceX in the space industry. And they seem to be doing whatever they just want to do. I have the impression that SpaceX is launching CubeSats by the thousands every day. I'm exaggerating here. So in how far is that covered by legal frameworks?
In outer space, though we are far away from Earth, no one operates in a legal vacuum. There is a cascade of legal levels, principles, and rules. You can start at international level with the main principles, how states, that is countries around the world, may use outer space or explore outer space. Very basic fundamental rules like that countries shall be liable for damages caused by their space objects. I'm simplifying here. Take responsibility that countries should cooperate, that the use and exploration of outer space is free for all states around the world. Such basic principles. Then if you make one step closer to, let's say, to our everyday life, when you go within one country, you'll find out that each country has the obligation, and not only the obligation, ultimately also the desire to regulate private space activities. You know, you don't want that your national citizens, be it people like you and me or companies, do whatever they want, because ultimately, if there are problems, it might fall back on you. And so you have at national level something we call national space laws. So they regulate what is allowed in that country, of course, in synchronization with international space law. How can a company, like the one you mentioned, like any other company, be authorized to do what it wants to do? So there is licensing processes, there are conditions, and there is a dialogue between companies and the authorities of the country that is, so to say, the host country. And that works fairly well. I'm not saying it works perfect everywhere, but especially, let's say, the more established space-faring nations do have a very detailed regulatory system in place in order not only to authorize and supervise companies, but also to incentivize and accompany and help them. And so that is something that helps us to really manage the expectation, allow business in space, and at the same time try that business doesn't get out of hand for the detriment of others.
So it's not a Wild West situation in space.
Today, outer space, thanks to more than half a century of space law development, is not the Wild West in the negative sense. It's important that we work together at all levels to keep it that way also in the future.
Interesting. Let's talk about one of humanity's most fascinating projects, that is the International Space Station. And the International Space Station is a very interesting focal point when it comes to space law, because so many nations were involved in setting up that beautiful piece of technology that's been around for 20 years now, and it's slowly and gradually coming to its end. But before that, let me ask you a very simple question. To what territory does the International Space Station belong? Is that America? Is that Russia? Is that, I don't know, Europe? What is it?
The perfect question for my favorite answer, it depends. You know, the ISS is really a beautiful place. It's a place of its own. It's unique. And I mean that not only from an engineering perspective or international cooperation. I mean this very practically speaking from a legal point of view. You have to imagine that the modules brought up into space and assembled together to form the International Space Station, what we call the ISS today, they come from different countries. They have been launched by different countries. They've been built by different countries. And as a matter of fact, they are owned by different countries. They have been registered by different countries. And the law on board of those modules follows the country of registration of those modules. And that's fascinating because many view the ISS as one unique big piece, whereas in reality, it's made up of many different small spaceships that have their own jurisdiction on board, their own law to follow. And depending where you are as an astronaut, you are maybe
interesting
in the United States or in the Russian Federation.
So if, very hypothetical, I wanted to commit a crime up there, I would want to make sure where I would commit that crime. So for example, I don't know, enjoy a little bit of intoxicating substances, for example.
If you wanted to commit a crime on board the International Space Station, that would first of all mean that the astronaut selection process probably hasn't properly worked, because those people flying today to the International Space Station
are all good people,
are really well trained in many, many senses, so that luckily so far we did not see problems of those kinds. But yes, it's one of the most favorite hypothetical questions. What happens if you commit a crime, if you stab a colleague on board of the space station? And a part of the answer, that would not be good and a mistake. Yes, legally, it depends who commits that crime where. And that's how you then have to approach to solve that case.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I love talking about such beautiful problems.
Many people love to talk about crimes in outer space, maybe because in so many science fiction movies, many crimes happen. But I tell you, in reality, spaceflight is quite peaceful.
We should take that as a good example here on Earth. So take space as a blueprint for the rest of us.
It's a wonderful thing you just said, take space as a blueprint for the rest of us. The International Space Station is a wonderful example in that regard. Despite geopolitical tensions on Earth, that laboratory where not less than 15 different countries are involved has always worked and functioned more than two decades. People from different nations on board, working, doing science. And it's often taken as for granted that, of course, the ISS works. But there's a lot behind there. By the way, also legal arrangements and international agreement that ties those 15 countries together in a very clever way. Mm. And it really serves ISS as an example of what we can achieve if we work cleverly together.
Is science the better United Nations?
Science is a part of the United Nations in reality, by the way. Scientists speak a common language. To solve a mathematical equation on the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere is ultimately the same. That distinguishes it from law in a certain way. Law is not necessarily the same. Science, yes. And so science is one of the tools that we have to learn to work together and to live together.
I like your diplomatic way of answering.
You know, almost 20 years of an international intergovernmental organization that leaves some traces, positive traces, I hope.
Nice.
But yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me ask you a fun question, but perhaps with a more serious background. As an astronaut, if I was assigned to go to the International Space Station, could I make this a business trip and apply expenses to that mission?
That's an excellent question. And to my embarrassment, I must say, I don't have the answer right here.
Would you know someone who has?
I can ask an astronaut, because that's the privilege that we have working at ESA. They are our colleagues. Wow. They have definitely the cooler office, but they are ESA employees just as we are. So you know what? I'll try my luck and I send a message and I ask the question.
Oh, Seriously, is this serious now?
Yeah, this is very, very serious.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, astronauts are human beings, and when they are not up there, they also have all kinds of jobs in ESA. And I ask one.
All right. That's super exclusive. Thank you so much for that. And you could also ask him as to if he had to bring his passport to the International Space Station.
I can tell you that you don't have to show your passport when you fly through the hatch into the International Space Station. No.
Let's stay on the International Space Station because it's nearing the end of its life. As far as I think, the program is officially packed at 2024, but NASA and other international partners are discussing an extension to at least 2028. But now it so happens that the space station at some point will want to return from whence it came. So it's only natural to want to keep the damage to a minimum so that the components, which weigh tons, sometimes don't fall on anyone's head here on Earth. But they have to fall somewhere, I guess. So now, how do you weigh up the different possibilities here on Earth? Who sits at the negotiating table, and how is such a matter being negotiated? Or do lawyers talk about it at all?
Oh, yes, of course. When there is imminent danger around, a lawyer can't be far. And I mean this in a very practical sense. You do need, of course, to look at the legal dimension of something like that. Yes, in fact, the International Space Station currently running until 2024, but possibly longer than that, one day will, in all likelihood, come down again, at least since Sir Isaac Newton, things in low Earth orbit tend to come down. The ISS does that every hour. Now that we speak, it comes down, just that we push it back up where we want to have it every few weeks or month. Now, one day, indeed, the day will come that the International Space Station will return to Earth, will be deorbited, and that will be quite a spectacular event for the sheer mass of it. And we can expect that not all will burn up in during the atmospheric reentry, though it will disintegrate in all kinds of pieces and burn to a certain extent. But yes, some pieces will impact Earth. And there, it's a very interesting coordination between engineers, so those who actually have designed the space station and to accompany the life of the space station, of scientists, orbital mechanics experts to calculate the trajectory that ISS will take coming back, but also of lawyers to a lesser extent, looking into what are the requirements that we have to observe if we have room and margin of maneuver, of course. What should we avoid? Whom do we have to alert? What kind of precautionary measures beyond technical measures do we have to take? And what happens if something happens? It's, by the way, not the first time that a space station will come back. We have had it in the past, Skylab, the Salyut stations, and most of all, Mir. When Mir came back in 2001, that was, I believe, 86 tons or so. That was quite an event and triggered also, of course, legal considerations. And on a lesser extent, we have that even in the European Space Agency. I wouldn't say it's a daily business, but I've seen it in my career several times that satellites come back. And sometimes you have what you call an uncontrolled reentry, so you cannot exactly predict.
I like that terminology, uncontrolled reentry. It's just crash, right?
An uncontrolled reentry is an uncontrolled reentry, yes. Everything crashes, but you can either have a controlled reentry, like you do it for humans. When you have our astronauts returning from ISS, you better have a controlled reentry. That means you know how and what trajectory, what corridor the astronauts come back, where to pick them up. Then you have semi-controlled reentry, where you can give some sort of last push to a space object in order to at least limit the geographical area where that space object comes down. And then you have the uncontrolled reentries where it's a bit a question of luck where it comes down. And that's something where when we have an uncontrolled reentry or even a semi-controlled one, we lawyers are part of the, let's say, the team preparing such a reentry campaign because simply you cannot rule out that something happens, even though the probability is very low. So if really a satellite coming back hits your car that is parked behind your house, then I think you can consider yourself very lucky, as long as you're not in that car. But then you can sell your car to, I guess, the local natural history museum.
Wonderful, Alex. What do such negotiations look like? Oops. Is that a message from the stars?
Let me check. That would be now also a little bit of luck if... Oh, yes. Yes.
Seriously?
Seriously? Very straight to the point. Just three words. Yes, they are. So, yes, the flights are actually missions.
And business trips.
Business trips.
Very interesting. So you get a little bit of additional money for your business trip.
Yeah, I don't think you get the kilometers first.
That would be unbearable.
But yes, you're definitely out of sight on a very, very complex business trip.
Wonderful, Alex. Thank you so much for this exclusive side trip. And now back to the negotiation table. So let's imagine you have all the ISS member states at the table. So what do those negotiations look like? Are there, for example, member states that would say, let the ISS crash over my territory, but give me some money in return?
No, that I think is maybe the way you see it in some movies. If you negotiate in the space world, that's much more down to earth, though the topic you talk about is exciting and fascinating. The negotiations themselves are down to earth. There are techniques how you negotiate, but most of all, it's almost a logic thing. You go into negotiations, and let's take negotiations for an international space station, a new international space station, just as an example. You will have representatives from those countries or space agencies who will do that, who will undertake that new space, to put that new space station up there. And they have specific interests, but most of all, they have the common interest to make it possible. So it's not like in a casino that someone says, yeah, I offer this if you don't do this, or I bring all the money I have in order to get the best deal. It's much more down to earth. We know already upfront what we can do, how much money we have, what, in the case of ESA, the expectations and wishes of our member states are, because in ESA, we don't go into negotiations doing what we want. We represent our member states. And so from the very beginning, let's say the stakes are somewhat set, then of course the devil's in the detail, and that's where then the negotiations take a while. But so far it has always worked out.
Wonderful. You mentioned techniques of negotiation. So that's a completely different topic now, but as I already mentioned, I want to take advantage of you being here. Would you tell me the three most important secrets? So how do I negotiate if I want something properly?
First of all, you should know what you want. That sounds like a funny piece of advice. And in space negotiations, we do know what we want. But if you ask now in everyday life, it's astonishing to see that sometimes people go into open-ended negotiations, which is not always very helpful. So you should know what you want. You should know what the other side wants. Yes, you will hear that eventually, but you should prepare yourself. So when you prepare for negotiation, it's not only what do we want and how do we say it? It's most of all, what do the others want and what will they say? And what will we say if they say what we think they will say? And how will we react if they don't say what we think they will say? So in a way, successful negotiations need anticipation and need a good deal of psychology to think with the head of the other side. Also, how can we help them to get to carry home a success they need? And how can they help us to carry home a success that we need? And then there is one more thing, listening. That is very helpful. Listening to what the other side has to say or says between the lines. And a third piece of advice, what is very healthy and useful in negotiations, are the breaks.
Coffee breaks.
When you actually interrupt, when you go to the coffee machine. in the evenings when you have the privilege, like we, when we negotiate, for example, with our colleagues in NASA and they come over to Europe or we come over to the US and we meet. And then in the evening, you go for dinner or you meet in the morning at the coffee machine. There you can build personal relations. And at the end of the day, personal relations, becoming friends, or at least understanding each other, being familiar to one another, that helps so much to achieve negotiations.
It reminds me a little bit of playing chess, because playing chess also means to anticipate the moves of the other.
Absolutely. I'm a passionate chess player, not a good one necessarily, but I like chess a lot. And it's exactly that. Having said this, not all negotiations are the same. Huh? It's very different sitting at the United Nations negotiating a diplomatic phrase in a treaty or in a resolution, let's say, a non-legally binding resolution, or sitting at industrial negotiations where it's about the money that you ultimately have to pay or triggering an insurance clause. So I'm not saying all negotiations look the same, and there might be cases where it's much less pleasant than these international negotiations are. Pleasant in the sense that it's a different spirit, it's a different pace, and different things are at stake when you sit with international partners to negotiate.
That's priceless. Is there any kind of example from a negotiation with a partner from a different cultural background where you might say, that's interesting to see how we all have different cultures when it comes to negotiating?
Two answers. One, yes, of course, and this is something absolutely fascinating. We have the privilege, we as lawyers in ESA negotiating space projects, we have the privilege to meet and talk with people from other cultures, from other countries. By the way, also from other professions, of course. In a negotiation team, you have to imagine we have some of our engineers, the experts, the project managers. We might have some business or finance people. We have the international relations colleagues who know how to break the ice and what is really important for the other country. We have the lawyers who know how to write text. So already that is intercultural. You don't even have to think of other countries. Then within ESA, you might have 10 colleagues in one team from 10 different European countries, where maybe simply by the cultural background, one person is more outspoken and one person is a bit more inward looking. And then on the other side of the table, you have the colleagues from that other space agency, from that other country. Look, in International Space Station, you had Japanese, you had US American, you had Canadian, you had Russian, and 11 different European partners through ESA, though, channeled. And there you have really a lot of different intercultural approaches, and you have to learn that as well. So yes, there are moments where you have to be a bit patient, both with the other side and with yourself, until you find common ground. You learn that then. So you know, okay, we go to country X, we know already how the negotiations will probably look like, and that it takes a bit longer, or it will be more direct, they come more straight to the point.
So we have protocol for respective countries.
Absolutely, absolutely. And second, even lawyers are not all alike. And there I can tell you from my own experience, an anecdote that I had to work a few years ago with a very good and cherished colleague, but she came from the insurance industry. And we had to write together, it was not a negotiation, we had to write together a legal instrument, piece of work. And I come more from this international law, United Nations, international organization background. And it was fascinating to see the way we approach to write a sentence, a phrase, where I tried to write the sentence in a way that you leave a little bit of, you know, room of margin of maneuver so that you have a little bit of flexibility, simply because I know how important that can be at the UN level, for example. And she tried to make that sentence as crystal clear as possible, because in an insurance contract, you cannot afford to build in a little bit of room of maneuver and then argue when you come to cross the bridge. And we had problems writing that sentence until we realized where our own legal cultural backgrounds are and how we were socialized in which environments, legal environments. And we had a good laugh. And since then, we work excellently together. And it needs both. It needs her clarity and it needs my diplomacy to reach then a good result.
Wonderful. Thanks for sharing that so openly. Alex, another question. What if I find as a hobby astronomer an asteroid of gold out there? Could I mine it, provided I find someone who brings my gear to the asteroid?
In principle, outer space doesn't belong to anyone. There is a famous sentence in the Outer Space Treaty, which is the most important treaty on principles pertaining to the exploration and use of outer space by states. And it says, outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, is not subject to national appropriation. But the question of resources, so if we go to a celestial body and want to mine, is a bit different from that. We're not speaking about taking the moon in possession and put a flag there and pretend that's your territory. Here we speak really about, is it possible to mine an asteroid or the moon? And that's a question that is discussed actually these days at international level, because it's an interesting question. Many countries say that must be or should be possible. Some say yes, but we need exact rules for that. And so it's really a topic at the level of the United Nations called the exploration of space resources.
Wonderful. Thank you. So if I happen to find an asteroid of gold, there is a potential that I could make use of it, perhaps in the future someday.
If you worded that carefully, I definitely have to say yes, there is a potential.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. Space lawyer by birth or by accident?
Space person by birth. Space lawyer by a planned accident, if you want to have it like that.
That's interesting.
Yes. Seriously speaking, the passion for space I had when I was 6 years, 7 years old. My first telescope at the age of 8. And I spent, I think, almost every night between 8 and 15 in our garden back at our home, my family home, observing the stars. I became guide at the local observatory. I learned the constellations and the sky inside out. I was a freak. I was really an astronomy freak. I lived in that world. And it was clear for me that my future career must somehow lead me in that world, in the space world. At the same time, I knew very well my limits in mathematics and physics and chemistry. Those limits were shown to me at school several times. And I realized what I do like and love is the romantic side of astronomy. I like to sit in the garden with a telescope, watch the stars. I like to guide a tour at the observatory. I like to wonder and dream about the planets. I don't necessarily like or would be good in calculating complex mathematical problems or find something on a computer screen. And so when the question was, do I study astronomy or not? And I talked to a lot of real astronomers, astrophysicists, and I realized that's actually studying physics. I said to myself, boy, not the best idea. Keep space as your passion. Don't make it your profession. But I found a back door, space through a back door. And I'm really happy to be in the space world, though not as an engineer scientist, who I really esteem and find wonderful, but as a lawyer, that's something that's much closer to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Tell me a little bit about that time. What made you consider yourself a freak?
Well, maybe at that time I wouldn't have called myself a freak because, you know, these sort of labels you give to yourself from a distance. The other day I had this binder in my hand with the protocols I wrote back then. You know, you must imagine at those times we still had typewriters, you know, where with two fingers I was writing a type of template for an observation protocol, so weather. Day, of course, date, time, weather, observed objects, and so on. I wrote that on a typewriter, and since I couldn't get exactly the perfect template, I actually cut out the words and then glued them on an empty sheet of paper. And then I asked my dad, going to work, that in a Xerox copy machine, he would actually make some copies for me because there was no other way to make more templates.
And make it look real.
Right? We speak here about the the 1980s. And he came home from work and had these, I don't know, 20, 30 copies. And those were my observation protocols. And those I filled out with passion. And I still have them here. And sometimes I look into them, the ink has faded maybe a bit over the years. But still, when I look at them, it's all as if it was yesterday, sitting there alone in the garden behind the telescope and watching. And my mom occasionally at the window saying, hey, it's now 1:30 in the morning. Don't you want to come to bed? Mm-hmm. Still two more objects. But there are wonderful memories associated to those times. I wouldn't like to miss them, I must say.
And how far is that all a prerequisite to get into ESA? So how many star constellations do you need to know by heart to get into ESA, to get the job?
My students often ask me, what do I need to get a job at ESA, for example? Now, there is one honest answer, of course, and that is to a certain extent, you have to be lucky. You're not the only one applying for a job. And it's difficult to say you or you are the best in absolute terms. When I applied for my first job, I can't say I don't even know. Was I the best? So you need a little bit of luck, be there at the right time, the right place. But then you need one more thing that helps you, and that is passion. If you apply for a job and at the end of the day, you don't care, that's not the best.
That wouldn't be the right way to approach things.
You would miss something. And I tell you, passion and the desire to understand what you're doing help you a great deal. I remember my job interview as a trainee, you know, a long time ago. I was not the only legal person sitting there in that interview. Of course, there were many. But I was maybe the only one or one of the few who could explain to the board how a satellite functions in basic terms, what a lawyer can do, and who could show to them that I have this passion to understand what I'm talking about in terms of space. And I think that made perhaps the difference. I don't know, but I think that impression made the difference.
So that's a nice piece of advice for aspiring space lawyers or people in general who want to go into the space industry, into ESA or whatnot, right?
Yes, and I encourage everyone to pursue your passions and your dreams. It sounds cheesy, but it's true. However, it's also important to have a plan B. This is something I tell to the many students I teach space law and international law in spare time beside my job at ESA. It's nice to be focused. That's important. But that shouldn't turn into something unhealthy, that you run after a dream that for one reason or another, because you might be unlucky, never materializes. And then you're unhappy and you have wasted a lot of time. There are other things than space that are also fascinating. There are other things than space law. And I had also my plans B and C that I might have activated then. So that's also important because it gives you a bit of peace of mind that you say, I have options. I would love that, but if that doesn't work out, I have other interests and I would love that as well, or that. And this is, I think, something that helps young people in a way to cope with the changing tides of luck that everyone has in his life.
Talk a little bit about your employer, ESA, and its role in the international space circuit. In how far, or what role do you see for ESA on the international stage in the future, especially when it comes to what the Chinese are planning, what the United States are having in mind, NASA, of course, what the Russians are having in mind, and what all those minor nations that are starting to prosper and bloom in recent years are having in mind. So where's ESA?
I think ESA is, always has been, and will be at the center of this landscape or spacescape that you just described, not alone in the center, but among those in the center. ESA has two important features, call them advantages or strength, whatever. ESA has been around for a long time and has a great deal of experience in doing spaceflight. Yeah? So it's a space actor, it's a space agency. At the same time, ESA is an international organization. It's in itself a mechanism of international cooperation. So it has also a great deal of experience in bringing governments and states together and doing things together. Now, the combination of that is really an asset also for the future. We know how to talk to others in order to make things happen. And we have made things happen again and again. That's not to boast or to be a reason to be put the hands on the desk and not move anymore. But these are the two strengths that I would see ESA as having.
Mm-hmm. So why is NASA still so visible? Why do I still, when I go to H&M or whatnot, and why do I find NASA logos on the sweaters and not ESA logos? Why is that?
Let me start by saying there are very cool ESA sweaters and jackets already out there, and t-shirts that, of course, as a matter of fact, I wear when I go to the beach, the ESA t-shirt. But aside of that, don't forget NASA, the NASA logo. It's not only a brand, it's almost part of pop culture already. And right. That has many reasons, but most of all, it has the benefit of the first one and the one who kickstarted and made one of the greatest adventures in the early days of spaceflight of humankind altogether. The moon landing, we still see today the effect. And I'm not speaking in scientific or technical terms. I'm speaking in terms of popular culture and the effects of the Apollo days. This logo is just something much bigger than the logo of a space agency.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the simple reasons. Then you can go more down on the practical level. But ESA is catching up. And we see, if you show anyone in Europe, at least, this famous E, the logo of ESA with the circle, it's recognized. And that's good to see.
I find ESA fascinating also because it's, I don't know, willingly or unwillingly humble about its achievements. And I'm afraid I have the impression that most or many of its achievements are too little known in the public. Some of the ESA achievements are fascinating scientific feats that no NASA or other agencies could have pulled off. And so I think ESA has great potential, especially when it comes to scientific missions. So is it perhaps that the Americans are more known because they have people on board their missions and ESA does the science? Would that be a differentiation we could make?
It's maybe too much of a simplification because we also do have European astronauts, ESA astronauts, and they do a very great deal of outreach in Europe and beyond. Wonderful work. At the same time, NASA has fascinating scientific missions. Planetary exploration missions. Just look at Mars, what's going on there. So that's not per se it, but it's true that, of course, human spaceflight has this attraction, this potential to attract. Why? Because we all see ourselves somehow in those people who fly into outer space, wishing it would be us, or we can at least talk to these people. That's always, that's fascinating. At the same time, don't underestimate the fascination of robots going somewhere, or even just under quotation marks, of an image of the Hubble Space Telescope, for example. The Hubble Space Telescope is also a pop star, by the way, a telescope where ESA is very much involved. And so each branch of space has its own fascination. And if you allow me to highlight one mission recent, that was the Rosetta mission, right? And the Philae on the comet, the landing on the comet, that triggered such an enormous public interest, a fascination, which...
Still giving me goosebumps.
It's giving you goosebumps. It's giving me goosebumps. And you see, these goosebumps were about a tiny little robot that landed on a dead piece of dust and ice and stone millions of kilometers away. And that shows you the power of and the fascination of space. And that was an ESA mission, and it was one of many fascinating missions. So let's not underestimate the coolness factor also here in Europe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's super cool because this little robot, Philae, is still sitting in that spot as we speak right now. And I find that heartbreakingly fascinating because this little piece, it's sitting there and never coming back again for the sheer reason that it landed in the wrong spot. Because, I mean, like, if I remember right, it landed in a spot where there was too much shadow and too little light. So its solar panels couldn't get the juice out of the sunlight. And so it just froze in time and space.
But it's doing fine. I think it's doing absolutely fine out there. I'm convinced. You know, speaking of goosebumps, let me tell you one more story. back in 2005, and I know the date as if it had been yesterday, 14th of January, 2005, European Space Agency landed on Saturn's largest moon, Titan. It was the Huygens mission with the lander on Titan. And on that very day, in the evening, we, that is, friends of the Austrian Space Forum and myself, we organized a space show. We rented a theater in my hometown of Salzburg in Austria, and we sold tickets, not very expensive tickets, and it filled the theater with almost 1,000 seats. So there were 1,000.
You're kidding.
And we organized, in that evening, the hours before the actual landing, kind of a space show where we had experts also online and live on stage, and we told stories about Saturn and about the mission and everything. And the highlight, it was timed like this, and we hoped it would work out, and it did, was that towards the end of the show, around 11 in the evening, the first image after the successful landing would arrive. And I tell you, it gives me goosebumps today thinking of it. When on that stage, with this gigantic screen that we had built up, I don't know, was it 8 times 5 meters or something like this? This image, black-white image, from the descending module, descending on Titan, appeared where you could see these dark sort of rivers of methane and the landscape. There was total silence in a room of full with 1,000 people. And then something incredible happened. When that picture was on the screen, full, we all on the stage, open mouth and not daring to breathe. And suddenly the people started to clap, but they didn't only clap, they got up. We had standing ovations for a black and white photo at midnight in my hometown. And this was such a strong impression. And it has accompanied me ever since, as you see. So I'm really glad and happy to have ended up in this world because it's just the coolest thing on Earth.
Wonderful, Alex. Thank you so much for sharing that. We are gradually moving towards the end of our beautiful show. So at the end of our show, we do have, and for the first time, I'm confronting an Austrian guest with this because you will very well know what this is all about. So usually an espresso is something strong. It gives you energy. And so my question to you would be, what's your espresso when it comes to space? When it comes to science, whatever story, without much thinking, off the top of your head, would you like to share with me and our audience?
I turn it around. If I need a space espresso and I hadn't had enough caffeine during the day working for ESA, then I sit down and I watch a good old episode of Star Trek. That's my space espresso, and I can recommend that. Being married to an Italian, I know exactly how important it is to distinguish different types of coffee. So if you need to be inspired, watch a good old Star Trek, and then you know why you're on that journey again.
Thank you so much, Alex. That was very inspiring. Thank you so much for being
pleasure.
On the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us today, wherever you are. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Exploring new worlds, especially also in the mind. We're so happy that our little podcast is growing thanks to you. If you like, leave us a review or a few stars. It's just a few clicks and helps us tremendously to grow. If you like what we do, spread the word. As always, you can find all the information at spacewatch.global. and we look forward to seeing you next time. See you then.